Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast for the design and manufacturing industry that explores how you can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Senior Industry Manager at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by two experts from the design and manufacturing world to discuss their perspectives on the challenges our industry faces and share what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain resilience, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for anyone that runs a design and manufacturing business who's interested in making things possible. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or via your favorite platform. Welcome to the podcast. Got a great topic to discuss with you again today. It's all around the way products are designed and made and brought to market, because the actual way we do that has changed, I would say, beyond recognition in recent years. And the race to disrupt the market and give customers the kind of like product experience they've come to expect is definitely on. And this seems like the perfect scenario in which to implement innovation and innovative thinking, and not just to the product development process, but also to the manufacturing process as well. But where does it begin, and how can you implement this kind of level of innovative thinking effectively? And exactly how can it lead to the sort of sustained, profitable growth that our industry desperately needs? So to help me unpack these questions, I've got two great guests with me today. I have Ben Manock, design engineer at Stellar Engineering, and Sam Rogers, a test pilot and design lead at Gravity Industries. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for the welcome.
Okay, so let's kick off by getting you to introduce yourself. So Ben, can you tell us a little bit about Stellar Engineering and the kind of work you do?
So Stellar Engineering is one company within a group of companies under the Stellar banner. Our main focus is motorsport. So we are currently an Audi factory-backed race team. Also, obviously, a proper English engineering firm. So we like to kind of make anything and everything. There's no limits to kind of what we strive to manufacture.
Perfect. Welcome. And Sam, if you could do the same, tell us a bit about Gravity Industries and the work you're doing.
Yes. Yeah, so Gravity builds jet suits, which is our term for a 5 turbojet engine powered suit with two arm mounts, one on each arm, and a backpack that produces about 150 kilos of thrust for the normal version. And it essentially allows a human to fly.
And I think people will be quite familiar with some of the really incredible videos that pop up on YouTube about these jetpacks being tested. So it's going to be a great conversation, and looking forward to having it with you both. So let's dive in. So Sam, perhaps we could stay with you. The term innovation is used a lot. The term innovative thinking is used a lot. And one of the questions that I guess people ask is, well, Where in the process of designing and making or bringing a new product to market or realizing an innovation, where does innovative thinking really start? And where would it have the most impact when it comes to bringing new products to market?
Well, we're at the stage where we've not actually fully brought a product to market. We're still somewhere between that prototype stage with wires hanging everywhere and something like a DJI drone, the ones that you can pick up from the shops, and you all you need to do is whack your massive sausage finger on the top on the button and the thing starts up, takes off, and you're already doing lovely cinematic shots. That is like a beautiful product of something very complicated that flies, takes amazing camera footage, loads of clever features, but all compacted into something very simple to use. And like I mentioned, the other end is something super prototypey with wires hanging out. Like if you knock it slightly, some plug comes undone and then it's not working. So it's not suited for using at events or anything like that. So we're on the journey between those two. It certainly looks a lot more like a product than it did before at the start, which was like DIY store aluminium with holes drilled in it. But now, because everything is 3D printed, it looks a lot more like a product. And along that journey, it's kind of been a journey of a lot of naive decisions, but we try them anyway. And I remember, I think James Dyson goes by a similar kind of testing process, where they kind of just try something, even if it sounds stupid, they'll give it a go anyway, and we'll give a few runs at something that sounds absolutely mad, And you tend to find that most of them are a dead end, but there's a few that end to a little lead of something that you didn't realize, some little physical phenomenon or whatever it may be. There is some kind of useful element to have done a test that sounds a bit stupid. So we've had lots of those, and some of those have kind of blossomed into really quite neat features of the suit. So to answer the innovation question, it would probably be, it comes from testing things that would be even considered naive by a traditional engineer, and especially being a bit, how would you put it? You could be a bit kind of, yeah, naive is the right word, or I'd just call myself thick in some instances. Like coming straight out of uni, you'd try things that go along a path that is very defined by the things you learnt on a course or at university. Whereas it makes a lot more sense to do it how I think those makers around the world have done it in their bedrooms, is to just try stuff and give it a go without any formal instruction apart from YouTube and Google searches. So that's the path that we've gone down, is just testing anything and everything, even if it sounds a bit mad.
That's really interesting. So you're talking about the concept of like just no constraints, just find something you want to do and don't be bogged down by how might I make it. So sort of the decisions you might make later on in the manufacturing process, because they could constrain you. So you're really talking about a zero constraints model. Just go out there and, I mean, it's not to make it a bit of a pun for your product, true blue sky thinking, right?
Yeah, you do just kind of, you try anything and everything, even if someone has an idea that sounds a bit kind of silly, and like, because it's very easy to go, oh no, that wouldn't work straight away. But if you actually apply a little bit of design time and testing to that, then sometimes, only sometimes, it results in something really interesting. And the other thing is that don't worry about the first design being ugly. All of our first prototypes are the most horrendous looking, bodged together, like I say, wires hanging out, bunch of bolts, or, you know, really uglily designed PLA prints off 3D printers and stuff. All the first ones are just crudely bodged together hunks of almost junk. But it just proves that first initial concept, and from there it's then a long journey of refining all these little improvements. For example, swirlers that for the intake of an engine, it's obviously breathing a huge amount of air. We went down this long journey of swirling dust out of the air by spinning it very fast so that the engine could then breathe as cleanly as possible in a dusty environment. And we spent ages kind of refining these things. But the first test was just a tube with some holes drilled in the side so that the air spins a bit. And I think it was even involved a bit of toilet roll. So it's not to worry about that first design looking a bit crude.
Great. What a great insight that is. So Ben, coming to you now. So you're in a different, I suppose, type of business model where I guess you're further down, if you like, the product development process. So I guess it's a similar question to you. I mean, has your product development process now really evolved or changed a lot in the recent years? And if it has, can you point to one single thing that kind of was the catalyst of that change? Because it sounds like what Sam is doing is their product development process is kind of very specific to the product and the industry they're in. I'm wondering if yours is similar, different, and if it's changed, and kind of what really drove that change?
Ours can be similar and different in its own unique way. Because we're a motorsport team, 50% of our production is specifically for ourselves. So if we're taking a product down that route, it's a very strange working environment, because every stage is in-house, even down to delivery to the customer, because we are the customer ourselves. So you get, in that aspect, you get a lot of kind of ideas and a lot of free-flowing thinking, because you know as a group what you want to achieve out of the product, and it's kind of plotting the points between the start and the end, and kind of knowing the end before you start is sometimes quite nice, because it allows you to think outside the box. It allows you to look at the product, whether something came before it and it's a second iteration or third iteration, or if it's a completely new idea. Whereas on the kind of normal engineering side, if it's made for a customer, a lot of the time the customer will come in and know they won't know exactly what they want, but they will know themselves what they want the end product to be. And that's a completely different way of thinking, because you don't have the kind of fluidity within the product to come up with these funky ideas, but you still have to try and build them in and make the product as best as it can be throughout the process.
And you just mentioned something really interesting there in terms of you use the word customer, and it just kind of made me think, because customers can be internal to the business and they can also be external. And you've and sort of Ben, you've got both in your business. You know, some of your colleagues and the business itself, you're kind of your own customer, but you've got external. And Sam, your customers are probably more external, right? And when you mentioned the term customer, it kind of just made me think that really, perhaps one of the goals around innovation is to really understand what the user experience needs to be, right? So you're designing a product, you're designing a process, you're designing a system, you're designing something, you've got to make it and bring it to market. But ultimately, someone needs to invest in this, and they're investing in it because they want to achieve a certain outcome or achieve a certain experience. So what are some of the ways, Sam, perhaps we could come back to you, how do you capture an understanding of that user experience and feed that into your design process?
So we test a lot of it on ourselves. The way we actually started flying and the way Gravity started was that Richard Browning founded it with that very early design, like I say, with the holes drilled in aluminium, and he proved the concept that a human can fly by just adding propulsion to the human body. All the control on our suit is done by the human body and how you move your arms. So he proved that initial concept, and then when myself and another engineer called Alex got involved very early on, we started experimenting with how can we make this more efficient, all of the usual buzzwords, but how can we make it more efficient to fly, how can we make it easier to fly and change the throttle in flight, lots of very kind of esoteric niche problems to solve while flying along, balancing on a load of jet engines. So the way we went about that was we started designing things, and then we would test them on Richard as he flew in this old farmyard with a tether attached to some old scaffolding. And during that time, it was over a Christmas, I think about 4 years ago, as kind of an afterthought, Alex and I started having goes in the suit just to kind of get an idea of how it feels. And we basically just span around quite a lot and got blown around. But we kind of got a feel for what it's like to hold these arm engines, because if you imagine you're slotting your arm into a sleeve, you're then grasping a grip which has to fit quite ergonomically to your hand, because it's putting a load of load into your hand, because that's what's lifting you. So that has to be quite an ergonomic grip. So you're holding this thing as you start up. There's some force from the engines when you throttle up. Obviously, you've got to keep your arms straight. You can't have your arm, we call it chicken winging, where you bend at the elbow. So it's trying to get familiar with all of these feelings that you're not accustomed to by having propulsion on your arms. So we started having these goes in the suit, like I say, lots of spinning around, lots of jumping up and down, but not really flying. But over a few months, we slowly became accustomed to actually wearing the suits and got to the point where we could fly. In fact, Alex and I took our first flights, one after the other, on some hardboard in this old barn that we'd moved to at the time. So that process was a lot of designing for ourselves, because we're kind of creating something new. We don't have a customer that's come in and said, we want to fly around leaning on a load of jet engines. It's all down to how can we, as much as possible, being at the time the only three people that fly it, how can we extrapolate from that and think, imagine if this was used in a paramedic situation where someone's actually bleeding out or someone's had an injury at the top of the mountain, and you need to get there as fast as possible. Imagine a paramedic has to just turn up at the bottom of the mountain, put this suit on, and go. All the buttons end up needing to be not a touchscreen. I'm not a big fan of touchscreen buttons in cars now, because you can't lean over and press them while you're driving. You've got to kind of look, and then your finger hits the screen, and it goes and slides along the screen. Now you've missed the button. Whereas lovely old-fashioned buttons that go click-clack as you press them are absolutely perfect to like suddenly turn on the hazard lights or air conditioning or whatever. So that's what this needs to be. It's not touchscreen buttons on a little touchscreen on your wrist like Buzz Lightyear had. It's massive buttons to like start the engines. Big red button here, press it. Everything whizzes into life, and 15 seconds later, you're ready to take off. So we kind of extrapolated as much as we could, and we still do, to what would be the features that would make this as usable as possible to someone in an intense situation where, you know, the suit's just fallen out the back of the car, they're jumping up and down on it, it's got to be robust enough to still work. So we used to try and make the most of thinking what those would be ourselves. And by using them a lot and testing them at events and in client training, when people come along and have a go in the jet suit, we refined a lot of that because we're putting loads of people through the suit per day as they learn to fly. And we're going and doing these paramedic test flight events. We're doing these events where, like, I did one where I flew onto live news by the Intrepid aircraft carrier in New York. And there's like a 5 second window where you've got to take off, fly in and land in front of the news presenter and then turn off the engines. So we had to make everything as easy to use as possible and as reliable as possible for all these mad events that we were lucky enough to end up doing. So from that, we'd refined it a good amount of the way. But now, because we're working with the paramedics and some of the special forces and doing more and more of these events, we've actually got other people that we're training to fly that are paramedics and actually do these things for real, that can offer their own feedback on how we design these things to actually work for them and work in their situation. Luckily now we get the feedback from other people because we've trained so many other people to fly. It's not just us kind of guessing.
Amazing. And so Ben, maybe a similar question to you in terms of, you also have customers, but your customers differ, I suppose, in some ways to the ones that Sam was talking about. So again, the concept of user experience or the customer experience, how do you go about gathering what that is and how do you factor that into the products that you design and make?
So again, that goes back to kind of the two different routes of customer, with it being, say, an internal project and it's being developed for ourselves, the feedback can be very honest at times. It can kind of take many forms. I like to say that it's almost you walk around a product with the people that are using it with a big red pen, and you just circle things they don't like, things they feel it can be improved. But the great thing is with us in that scenario, the people that are building the products are the people that are using the products. Because we're quite a small team, all of us go racing when we go racing. And we're also here for the engineering side when we're building stuff. Whereas when it's an external customer, it can vary. It very much depends on the person. Some people are very vocal about things, or other people aren't. In terms of me personally, I will always like to have a very honest and frank conversation about whether someone likes something or they don't. And again, it kind of being customer facing externally, you have to be able to read people quite well and understand exactly what they are wanting to get out of the product.
You're both talking about, as I'm hearing you speak, you're both talking about, we call it a collaboration. The ability to collaborate much earlier in the project seems a critical way to connect with your customers, whether they're internal or external, and sort of gather their sort of feedback, gather their kind of their comments about the experience you're designing for them and maybe even understand some changes and iterations you might need to make. And that's quite common, I would say, when you ask for feedback, you get it, right? And sometimes feedback can be brilliant and it can be, wow, what a great idea. I hadn't thought about that before, because you're putting yourselves in the shoes of your customer. Sometimes feedback, it's a bit crazy, and I'm using the polite word there. I mean, you might get some feedback, which you just think as engineers, that's never going to work. And you can't really say to a customer, internal or external, or maybe you can. You can't say that's a really stupid idea. I suppose you've got to prove why it would or would not be a great idea. How do you guys go about doing that? So, Sam, let's sort of come back to you. I mean, have you had examples in the development of the jetpack where somebody said something stupid like, I don't know, I want a water cooler machine on the back of it so I can have a drink of my favorite Perrier water as I fly, or something equally crazy like that? And how did you validate it would be a good or a bad idea?
Well, we try to go by the principle, which sounds very cheesy. It's just like, oh, there's no bad ideas or whatever. But that sounds a little too cheesy. Mm. It's really down to not rejecting anyone's idea straight away, because in the end, you'll just make that, if it's a team member, feel uncomfortable, which you don't want to do. And it's most of those ideas that sound stupid immediately. If you think about it for a second, there's a useful piece of it. Again, it's very hard to describe an example of this, but often that complete naivety for a certain aspect is what leads to, well, maybe you could do this in an entirely different way. So it's actually really useful in that sense. But we do have some funny questions where people come up to us and ask, can you go into space with this and all this kind of stuff? And obviously they're turbojet engines, so they're air breathing, so you can't go into space. So they sound kind of like silly questions, but it's a fair enough question to ask. Unless you're bothered enough to research how turbojet engines work, I don't blame you for wondering why. It sounds as loud as a rocket. Flames come out the nozzles, so fair enough. But you've got to just appreciate the background that everyone else comes from. So we can have a little giggle to ourselves, but in the end, as cheesy as it sounds, we just try and accept all of those ideas. And often there's a niche of goodness or some new creative way of thinking about the problem within those.
It goes back to what you were saying about right at the beginning, that one of the first questions I asked you mentioned, or we talked about, innovative thinking can apply across the entire life cycle. It feels like it's most impactful right at the start of the process, but you've got to adjust this kind of zero constraints, no judgment mindset. So it seems like you've got to carry that mindset right throughout the whole process, because as you say, sometimes the craziest of ideas, or what might seem the craziest of ideas, within them there might be this sort of spark of a really good potential new product or a feature enhancement. Or I guess if you understand the why is somebody saying, can I fly into space in your jetpack? Is there a definite need, or is it a hobby? Or I suppose you can get beyond the suggestion and look at the why.
Well, I think it's an extension. It's an extension of the question that everyone usually asks, which is how high can you go? And the answer is up to thousands of feet.
Right.
6,000 feet is where the air gets a bit too thin for us to we'll be able to hover about 6,000 feet. But by that point, because the air density is lower, you're getting less air into the engines and less thrust. But obviously, for safety reasons, we always fly really, really low, because your iPhone can crash, or any other brands are available, can crash at any time, and so there's always a possible problem with any piece of technology. Now, it's got to a point where the suits are really reliable, but for all the displays we do and shows, there's no point in going high. It's better to be close and impactful. Mm. For all of the paramedic flights up a mountain that we do, It's better to stay low, because in case there's any kind of problem, all you're doing by going high is creating more risk,
right?
And higher winds and all these other issues. So you might as well stay low. And it's great because you can ground hug your way up the terrain, and you get a better idea for the terrain. And like I say, it's safer. So that's the kind of mentality that we've ended up approaching how we fly. But I'm interested, how many different customers do you end up actually working with, Ben? What does someone come in and say? Do they say, is it, I want a car that does this? Or what will they actually come in and say? And how long does it usually take from them saying that to something being delivered, or like a first prototype?
We get every kind of wildly different requests from people, down to tubes that have got a million holes in them in random places, to bits for cars, to even down to someone saying, I've bought these new rims, I need you to get them to fit to my car. And it's, okay, let's have a think about this. But one of the good things about us being so small is that the prototyping stage can be very quick. If it's a small product, we have managed to turn things around in a day. So 9 o'clock in the morning, you sit down, you have a meeting, you say, okay, we want this, 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 and this. And by the end of the day, you're ready to go into manufacture. Because because of us being such a small team, we have a very, in a weird way, we have a very big knowledge base, because a lot of our people that work within the company are a little bit older, have been in the industry for a very long time. So you can almost skip steps in the process, and which enables the thinking to be a lot more innovative, because you don't have to second guess these new, strange, funky ideas.
Yeah, that's brilliant. We have exactly the same thing. We have quite a small, nimble team of people that maybe this is not what you do, but we're not so bothered about the perfect engineering drawing. Most of our engineering drawings consist of the WhatsApp function, where you use different colored pens and just draw over pictures of things and diagrams. So if you were to look at it, you would think, oh, what has this child drawn with crayons representing the next suit we're going to build? But in reality, it's just the quickest way we've ended up working with each other is, silly, colourful drawings on Messenger. So having that tiny team of people that have got to a point where they know each other well enough that they kind of know what they're thinking. Everyone has the same willingness to skip the engineering drawing step and just make that first prototype that works has been excellent. And I bet if you've got, like you say, some more seasoned members of your team who have worked in motorsport for an incredibly long time, they're already able to just go, they already know if a certain part of a design or some weird idea has worked because they've just done it before. When I used to work on rocket engines, he's now a chief designer, but he'd worked on rocket engines in Ukraine for many, many years. And it's someone that I had just always wished I had spent time with while I was learning about rocket engines when I was growing up. You could literally ask him anything and he could say, oh yeah, we tried that. You need a certain concentration of hydrogen peroxide here. The orifices need to be this size or something like that. He'd be able to just reel off when we tried that and how well it works. They've had so much experience that you can just, half of the idea that's come in has already been tested through their background knowledge, and they can already just knock off a load of things that will and won't work. So it's fascinating working with people like that. The small nimble team is something that's been so, so valuable to us.
I've just got millions of questions exploding in my head now. I'm trying to capture them all. So two things that I heard there, I think it'd be really worth delving into a bit more. When we talked about balancing, I think, Sam, you call it the seasoned members of the team with maybe sort of the newer members of the team. I'm just wondering how much a blend of new versus existing skill sets is a factor on innovation. That's question number one. And the second one is, one of you said, Ben, I think you said, like, we work together. And I'm just wondering, does that mean you physically have to be in the same location, or could you be as innovative if you were distributed across different locations? So let's go to the first point. And the reason why I've put both those questions up so I don't forget. The first question is around, is there a perfect blend of seasoned, say, crusty old engineers like myself working side by side with the next generation of engineers like you guys? Do you think there's a perfect blend, or does it not matter? Let's go to Ben on that one.
Personally, I think that's huge. I think that's one of the biggest and most important kind of factors in any design and manufacture process. You have to have what I like to call 21st century thinking alongside good knowledge base and understanding of what you were trying to do and how you'll go about doing that. Because I mean, as designers, we could go out and design anything and everything, and it could look aesthetically amazing, it could work, but you just couldn't make it. And I'm forever falling over customers that come in and say, right, I would like to achieve this, 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 and this. And you say, well, there's a better way of doing that, but it might not achieve the end goal in the same way that you're hoping for. That kind of variation in knowledge is so important. And like, because we all go away racing together, we spend a lot of time together. It's almost like an engineering family, a motorsport family, which is very important, which also enables when we come back to the factory, the conversations you can have can be a lot more honest and you can achieve things a lot quicker because you're not having to kind of dance around normal ways of working. I can walk downstairs and have a conversation with someone and come back upstairs and I've only been gone 5 minutes and I've got the answer I wanted. Whereas in other situations, you might have to send an email to this person who might be in Germany and they're no longer at work because of the time difference, or you end up waiting and a 5 minute problem becomes a 4 hour problem.
And do you think it would be as effective in your case if you were distributed across different locations and you kind of had to do like remote collaboration, you know, the Zoom kind of stuff that we've all become used to? Would it be as effective?
I don't think it would be as effective in all honesty. I wouldn't say it wouldn't be effective, but you would lose that ability to have those 5 minute conversations because you almost have to chase someone because you can't just walk downstairs. But on the other side, I think with the way the kind of the design workspace is going and even how it currently is, designers and people on the manufacturing side can collaborate a lot easier because they can work within the same workspace and everything's becoming a lot more visual and it's easier to pinpoint issues when you've almost got it in front of you.
And so, Sam, do you have an example then of this kind of like maybe sort of remote collaboration in action? And do you have a specific example of how it helps you overcome a challenge, which you probably would have struggled to overcome otherwise? I mean, I'm assuming you've worked with people from all over the world in different locations and had to, you know, not everybody's physically in the same location. So do you have an example of that?
Well, yes. So the wider team of Gravity is spread all over the world. But the core design is mostly in the UK. And then there's a small team of us that come together and test everything. And we kind of do it in like a sprint. We'll design a lot of stuff, wait for it to arrive, because almost everything we do is 3D printed. And then we'll put it all together and go and test everything and then digest the learnings for that for a bit and all go away and have a break from each other. And that, I mean, that's a point we can talk about in a minute, Ben, is actually 3D printing, because you'll have loads of people come in and say, you know, I want this, this and this. That's why we've moved to 3D printing everything, because you can just produce all of the buzzwords that they say about 3D printing, almost any geometry. You can have loads of internal channels. But it's been brilliant for us because we can iterate the design every time we make one. But we'll talk about that in a minute. In terms of remote type work, most of it is run on messenger apps of one form or another. And like I say, sending pictures back and forth. How can we do this? Taking pictures of the suit flying and looking at additions we want to make. We're, like I say, none of the suits are the same. Every single one has modifications from the last, and every single one has little additions like hooks and catches. Everything's got to be quite tactical, so you can kind of click and lock things on. Like a radio mount for the paramedics or something like that. We're always adding stuff. So that is almost primarily just messaged to each other through silly pictures with drawings on them. And then they're all stored and we can go back through those. And while we're making the design changes in CAD, we can just go through all those lists. So that's kind of how we work. And everything's run on messenger apps really for us. But going back to the previous point of having older experience as part of your team, I used to work on rocket engines before working on the jet suit. I was working on these additive manufactured 3D printed copper rocket engines. And like I mentioned, there were some designers who I got to hang out with who just have almost seemingly infinite knowledge on how to build these engines. They've tested them and fired them all their lives. So while designing the new ones, like new space companies are, they lean on their experience with new manufacturing technologies like 3D printing, and they can make structures and things that they were never able to when they were just able to machine things traditionally or use traditional processes at the time. The difference with us is nobody's built a jet suit before, so we don't have an old hand at building jetpacks and jet suits. So maybe we're becoming that. I mean, I feel like for the number of years we've done it, we'll at some point be the old hands on how to build a jet suit. But for now, we've not had that because everything we're trying is quite new, which has been tremendous fun. And it means we get to learn all of those silly mistakes early on and make all those failures, which is what we've ended up calling type B fun. Type A fun is fun while you're having it. Type B is not fun at the time, but fun in retrospect. So all of those failures that we've learned from have been type B, and we get to look back on them as kind of fond memories of why on earth did we try that?
You mentioned 3D printing, and I think that's a really good topic to jump into. So, I mean, I know it's a specific piece of technology. We're not really trying to delve too much into technology, but it does seem to solve some of the challenges that companies come across when you're innovating. What is it about 3D printing? Ben, maybe we'll jump to you. I'm not sure if you use 3D printing in the business extensively, but what is it about 3D printing that you think helps accelerate the innovative process or the innovation process?
We have had a little bit of kind of use of 3D printing. Our main way we used it was to test fit components to vehicles. So if you've got kind of a new damper coming in, and you just want to be completely sure that it's going to fit, you're going to be happy, you're not going to foul on a chassis leg or something odd. So we've used it in that respect. I think it kind of the wider engineering environment, 3D printing will really, really take off in the coming years because, as I say, it's the ease. As more products come on stream and you're able to print more materials, the uses will just grow and grow and grow. And it's time of manufacture because you're only ever dealing really with the model. You're not producing drawings or things like that. You're kind of trying to think of how to word it. The manufacture time is is vastly reduced, which then results in a better cost saving at the end of the product.
Yeah, we've seen a similar thing where most of our orders take about a week, so we'll design everything. And a key point actually is not owning the printer. So we own lots of small 3D printers of the FDM style, the extruding style, because they're just built to be desktop printers. And we have a lot of those in the lab because we can test anything the same day. But any of the larger SLS style printers, and for those that don't know SLS, it's definitely my favorite type of 3D printing. And you get a lovely matte surface finish over everything, no layer lines. The machine is the size of like four American double fridges, if not more. And they have them at a bureau site. So we use a series of different bureaus where we'll send the parts out and they'll get sent to us, because these machines get updated every year or so. And there's no point in us buying a machine that's like £1 to 2 million every single time a new one comes out. So these bureaus have kind of rolling contracts where they get the new ones already. So we get to use the latest technology by just buying the parts in from a bureau. And that takes about a week usually. So from us sending off an entirely new suit design to receiving it, and we design it as much as possible to be assembled very quickly, so everything slots together. It's not like trying to line things up and glue them in place. It's just everything, tongue and grooves, thump, straight together, slots in place, and then we can either rivet it, adhesive it, or whatever else we do. So printing has just been incredible for us, because you're trying to wedge a load of thrust up against a person, and a person is a big, soft, gooey lump which changes shape whenever they move around and bend and all this kind of stuff. And the ideal material we've always said would be a car tire, because you can chuck a car tire out the back of an aircraft, it'll hit the ground, bounce, and look exactly the same as when you threw it out. So that would be ideal. So we've ended up we started actually with nylon, and nylon 3D prints are great and robust, but if you surprise them, like smacking a ruler on the desk, then they shatter into loads of little pieces. Even if those rulers said they were shatter resistant, they would shatter into millions of pieces. And that's what nylon did. Whereas now we print in a lot of polypropylene, and this stuff you can sit on and it'll just wang and flex, which is fantastic. So it's a step closer, but still not as good as that car tire rubber. So we print in a lot of that material now in large machines, like I say, the size of four double fridges. That arrives, slotted all together, and then we've got something to test. And the great thing about 3D printing is we're not designing an entire tool path every time you send the file to be manufactured. Because if we sent like a part for machining, Ben, you'll know more about this than I do, but you have to set it up for machining and you kind of design the tool path so that the bit can get in there, do all its cutting away. Obviously, the bit can't go inside and hollow something out because it can't physically. Whereas with printing, you're just printing the shell of what you want. So everything has quite thin walls, it ends up quite light. And you just hit generate on the printing file and then send that to the printer. There's no personal involvement in setting up the toolpath for that. So it means we can just send off a new file, and then on the next one, we make a little tweak, send it again. There's not much work. They just hit generate, fling it into the machine, and it prints over a couple of days. So it's brilliant for us because of all those crazy internal geometries and weird shapes that we need to do to butt up against a human's spine and forearms and all these weird features that humans have. Like if you actually look at a person, we've got these weird little caterpillars on the end of our stumpy arms. Like, what are these things? I know it sounds very weird, but we are a very strange shape. Like your chest breaks down into each limb, and then at the end of each limb they break down to another series of weird little offshoots we call fingers, and this is the thing we're trying to interface with a load of propulsion shoved on the end of your arms.
I suppose what we've uncovered here is, of course, we've been starting to talk about innovation as it's a really focus around the product or the experience you want to offer to the customer, but innovation and innovative thinking could equally be applied to the manufacturing process, right? Or even the design process. And 3D printing is a great example of it. You know, Ben, do you have an example of where you've applied innovative thinking to the manufacturing process? And is there an example you could share of the benefit that's had to the business?
I think our biggest area at the moment within kind of innovative thinking in manufacturing is material. Using the correct material and making sure that you're happy with that material. So a good example of that is we did for a customer. They were very, very complicated and very awkward. They were almost arms that had, so there was one on either end of a big thick steel wire, And what it was used for was it was to hook into the apex of the roof of a barn that they were converting that was 200 years old, and the walls were half falling down, and it needed to kind of be pinned across the top of the walls and within the roof. So with that, they wanted a lot of them. And there was a lot of different ideas being thrown around about how to kind of get this idea to work. And what we did was we sat down, we came up with two or three designs, all were strange in their own wonderful way. And instead of going into a manufacturing process where, because it had to be made out of stainless steel, but we were unsure on the grade. And while that decision was being taken, we decided to proceed with manufacture of the products in order to test them. So although they weren't going to be tested as in put up and load to be put on them, we wanted to make sure that just the physical characteristics of them were correct. So we manufactured the first, I think it was three out of aluminium. They were then taken away and tested, and then a lot of feedback came back from that, which then meant that the final decision on material could be made, and it actually enabled us to source a better material at a better cost.
Okay, so we're going to switch gears a little bit here now and talk about barriers. Quite often, the concepts like innovation or collaboration, any sort of concept, they all sound very powerful, don't they? But when we put ourselves in the shoes of, or you guys already are in these shoes, but when you put yourself in the shoes of like a manager or a director of a SME type design and manufacturing company, people struggle. People struggle to bring in concepts like innovative thinking or collaboration or flexible manufacturing. They genuinely struggle. And so I'm interested in what you both see as some of the biggest barriers. What's stopping more companies adopting this kind of like innovative thinking mindset, the sort of things that we've been talking about today? Sam, let's start with you.
The thing we've seen most is just risk aversion and everyone trying to cover their back from doing something that might fail. And I'm at risk of going into something that's overplayed now, which is the don't be afraid of failure monologue that people often go on podcasts and when they're interviewed. But there is a lot of being afraid of failure and not trying something that, as we mentioned earlier, could be perceived as a bit silly or a stupid idea. So we just try to stay as far away from that as possible. And like I say, try all of the ideas, even if they sound silly to a degree. And you see a lot of ideas that often sound like a brilliant idea at first, and then everyone gets excited, and then they die over time because people spend too much time talking about them. If you've organized a conference call about it and no one's done anything yet, then it's probably already too late. The person who came up with the idea should have built a prototype. If it's a physical thing, it could be, it could be anything, it could be digital, but say it's a prototype, they should have built something out of some weird old Fresnel lens and a piece of toilet roll and duct tape, and then on that first meeting, if it's digital or in person, they can hold the thing up and go, this is kind of what I was thinking, but I discovered while making this first prototype this shape doesn't quite work because I can't fit my arm in it, or something like that. But it's just that very first step, taking the crude, ugly first step is the hardest bit, and actually doing something. Again, I'm at risk of repeating what lots of people are saying at the moment, but it is actually really hard to do. I've found it with lots of projects where just taking that first step, and you'll learn something immediately. As soon as you try the first silly version, you'll learn something straight away. So that's what people seem to be scared of. And especially in large corporations, we've seen this loads with anything from trying to do TV shows to jet suit events and any of that kind of stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of talk and there's a lot of initial interest, but then it slowly dies because people are like, oh, well, what if this happens? What if that happens? And then it just doesn't happen. So it incentivizing taking some risk so that the failure is not seen as a failure. It's seen as a learning. And at least you tried that option. We've defined that way doesn't work. But out of the 10 ways we tried, one of them seems like it has a little hint of something that actually could work.
Yeah. Okay, great. Ben, how about yourself in terms of, either in the work you're currently doing or when you work with your suppliers or other customers, what are some of the biggest barriers that you see that prevent more organizations adopting this level of innovative thinking?
I think with kind of the way engineering as a whole is heading, like we've discussed, kind of additive 3D printing, all those new technologies that are coming in. I think in a strange way, they are a barrier to themselves, because especially given the current climate with the costs of everything, with people being a lot more kind of unwilling to spend large amounts of cash, I think the new technologies are kind of limiting themselves because of the cost. Whereas in time, the cost will come down for these, and they will no longer be new technologies, they'll be current technologies. But then within the company, we have an ethos that nothing's a barrier. We've been told enough times that you can't do it, and then we've gone and done it. It's never kind of, it's more a limiting factor, but you can work your way around limiting factors.
Again, it's that mindset approach that we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, isn't it? Which is brilliant, because, you know, we haven't really talked about technology apart from 3D printing. Everything that we've been talking about is really all about no judgment mindset, no constraints, nothing's impossible, that kind of stuff, which I think is within the power of every single leader of every single design and manufacturing company to kind of like do something about. So that's pretty positive. So my next question is, I'm going to ask you both the same question, is just imagine that every single leader of every single design and manufacturing company in the world is listening to this podcast. I wish they were. We'd be great for our subscriber numbers. And we've got the opportunity to, each of you have the opportunity to give them one piece of advice. What's the one piece of advice you would give to a leader of a manufacturing or a design company who sits down and says to you, I wish I could bring more innovative thinking into my business? So Ben, over to you. What's that one piece of advice you'd offer a leader of a manufacturing company who's kind of like, I'd really like to be more innovative and more innovative thinking, but where do I start?
I think my response would probably be incorporate more risk. I know it's probably outside of what people think you should say or think you should do, but without risk, you're not going to gain anything. Even if it goes badly, you will still learn something. You'll still take knowledge into the next step, as long as it's not super high risky. Everything's on the line on this one little detail. But if you take those risks, sometimes they won't work, but sometimes they will work. And when they do work, they pay back far more than the risk ever was.
Okay, so Sam, same question to you.
So mine would be, do something silly. So maybe do a, if it's a leader of a manufacturing company, then we've already got that niche, it's manufacturing. So maybe go and get your engineering team to build a soapbox racer and take part in the soapbox race or something like that. Or go and build a model rocket or something, but have a sense of silliness to it and fun, so that it becomes a really enjoyable experience. It's not got to be for a serious customer. Just go and get your team to do something for 1% of the time or 5% of the time, something silly. So they're all working on a project where you can just express yourself and, you know, put little jokes into the design, because it's tremendous fun doing like that. And because we're a small group at Gravity, we do that with lots of designs anyway. If you nestle down into the crevices of the backpack, you'll see little insults between myself and Alex, the guy working on the electronics, written in the design, just about where the electronic loom goes and how it's not going to work, and it's just a random number generator. So doing something silly, I think, would be a brilliant way to probably help build the team, but also try a load of new techniques that don't matter because it's not a customer project. So buy a load of these cheap 3D printers that you can get on Amazon for a couple of hundred pounds and just experiment with them, both resin, FDM printers, and just give them a go because it's cheap and it's a small risk to take, and you've got a project that doesn't have any massive stakes to it if it goes wrong.
That's interesting because it maybe touches upon what Ben said. It's like, get comfortable with risk. But if you can get comfortable with risk on something that doesn't have a business impact, maybe your appetite for risk will grow up, and maybe that sort of like will bleed across into your day-to-day work. So yeah, really good bits of insight there. So now I'm going to try and summarize what I think I've learned from this conversation with you both. I would say that innovative thinking, it isn't really just about the product. I think a lot of companies might look at it as the product. It's an important part of it in terms of like, what does a product do? How do you make it? Even what you make it from, we talked about materials, but it's equally about the experience. It's about the process of how you might bring that product and that experience to market. I think I heard you both say that it would apply to every stage of the design to manufacture a stage, but from everything you've both said, it seems to have the biggest impact if you can bring it in right at the start of the process, right at the start where things are super creative and nothing's committed, nothing's no materials cut, no promises have been made. So it seems to have the biggest impact if you can apply that thinking right at the front. And that was the other thing that I got clearly from you both. It's definitely more of a mindset as opposed to literally kind of a process that you might follow. And if you can apply that mindset to understand the experience or value that you're trying to generate, like I want human beings to experience what it's like to fly, and you can put yourself in the shoes of the customer and start collaborating with them and be prepared to refine as you go, then I think you're in a really good place to start applying more innovation and innovative thinking into your business. But you need to keep that zero constraints, zero judgments mentality. I heard you both say that it's a great way to keep that alive is to blend the 21st century thinking with the more experienced traditional thinking and get your first version out as soon as possible, no matter what it looks like. And the best bits of advice for anyone listening is I kind of like the idea, pick something silly, pick something which has got a sense of creativity and fun about it that's not high risk to the business. Let your team loose on it. And that's a great way that you might be able to make friends with risk. And then perhaps that's a way for us to bring much more innovation into our day to day. So I hope that kind of reflects, our conversation pretty accurately. It's been absolutely brilliant fun having this conversation with you both. Of course, I'm going to say to you both that next time I'm in the area, I'd absolutely love to pop in and just have a chat with you in some more detail. But for now, I'd like to thank my guests. So Ben Maddock, design engineer at Stellar Engineering, and Sam Rogers, the test pilot and design lead at Gravity Industries. Thank you so much, and I hope you enjoyed the experience. And we'll talk to the rest of you again on the next episode. So thank you.